Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
Guys, we are back. We are so excited. It is season 2 of your favorite New Girl Rewatch podcast. We have got a new season. We got a new name. We have got some of your favorite people from the New Girl universe. We've got the creator and showrunner, Liz Merriweather. We got the Max Greenfield, Olivia Munn.
We also have some of your least favorites, like Jake Johnson.
Lamorne.
Hannah, what's up?
We do have Jake Johnson, though.
Yeah. Listen to The Mess Around on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do, 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 do. We all know what that music means. It's time for the Olympics in Paris.
I'm Matt Rogers.
And I'm Bowen Yang.
And we're doing an Olympics podcast? We're hosting the Two Guys, Five Rings podcast. Watch every moment of the 2024 Paris Olympics beginning July 26th on NBC and Peacock. And for the first time, you can stream the 2024 Paris Games on the iHeartRadio app. And listen to Two Guys, Five Rings on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Andrea Gunning, host of the all-new podcast, There and Gone. It's a real-life story of two people who left a crowded Philadelphia bar, walked to their truck, and vanished.
A truck and two people just don't disappear.
The FBI called it murder for hire. But which victim was the intended target and why? Listen to There and Gone South Street on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the early morning hours of January 24th, 2001, gunfire erupted in front of a house in Detroit, Michigan. 25-year-old Jamon McIntyre ran toward a nearby alley where his assailants finished the job. Initially, two alleged witnesses claimed that they didn't see the assailants. But a few weeks later, one of them identified three men from a photo array, including Anthony Legion. Despite claims of innocence from all three men, an alleged cellmate claimed that they said differently in private. But this is wrongful conviction. Wrongful conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison, and now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and tell us how these stories make you feel and what you've done to help the cause, even if it's something as simple as telling a friend or sharing on social media. And you might just hear yourself in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, where we've got another Detroit case that involves a drug house, a dirty cop playing both sides, a dead body, no eyewitnesses, only fabrications, including a jailhouse snitch. And it appears that a drug syndicate may have been pulling a lot of the strings here and joining us, one of the survivors of this insane story, Anthony Legion. Anthony, thanks for doing this with us.
Thanks for having me.
And returning to help tell this story, a guy who we met in New Orleans at the 2024 Innocence Network Conference, civil rights attorney Wolf Mueller. Wolf, welcome back to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you may remember Wolf from Daryl Siggers' story, another case out of Detroit, where it seems like police misconduct was basically the norm, especially when it came to fabricating witness testimony and using jailhouse snitches.
The Detroit Police Department, and particularly the homicide section, in the late 1980s, all through the 1990s and extending the early 2000s, if they had a weak case, they would recruit some snitch, typically from what would be the ninth floor jail, where you're only supposed to be held there for about 48 hours before you get transferred to the county jail. But some of these guys on a ninth floor were in the ninth floor lockup for a year or more, and they had sheets over their cells, which were off to the side. They had VCRs, they had TVs, they had food, they had drink, they had everything, because they were regular snitches for the DPD. And what three of them have said under oath is we would get discovery packages from the detectives, told to memorize it, a handwritten statement from the homicide detective saying how this guy confessed, and all you had to do was sign it. And so they had these extra benefits that nobody knew about. And then one guy got off on a second-degree murder charge, which was 12 to 25 years after doing 7 years. And the testimony from one of the homicide detectives was, he's helped us out in about 20 cases. Well, there is no way any reasonable juror would ever listen to something like that and think 20 different people who didn't know you confessed to murder.
It's hard to believe this is real life, but here we are. And if you don't remember the case of Larry Smith Jr., well, we're going to have it linked in the episode description. The circumstances are similar to what happened to Anthony and his co-defendants, Marvin Cotton and Devontae Parks, in the city that they all called home.
I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, 70s, 80s. My mother and father had been married until my father passed, so for over 30 years. So, you know, I had a structured home. You know, Detroit was on the rise. You know, it was jobs, the factories. You know, I had a pretty good childhood, went to school, graduated from Cody High School, played sports, you know, just a normal childhood life. Engaged with the young ladies in the neighborhood prior to my incarceration. I was 27 years old. I had two children by one young lady. And right before I got incarcerated, she had found out she had cancer. And when she found out, our relationship wasn't on the best of terms. So just imagine how that felt when she found out that she had that and I already wasn't the best, you know, boyfriend. So it was difficult. Me and her had kind of split up, but I had to step up to the plate and, you know, take care of my children. My son, who was 2, and my daughter was like 7 at the time. So I had them living with me and, you know, they would go back and forth, but she was going through these treatments. So I had the children with me for the most of the part. And, you know, I was into real estate, investing money in real estate and things of that nature. So I was at home a lot with the children.
At 27 years old, Anthony had a full plate and a meaningful career with no real connection to the victim, Jamon McIntyre, or what became the crime scene, a place called the Third Street House.
From all the police reports and what the police officers knew is this was a drug house maintained and kept by Jamon McIntyre, who was related either by blood or they call them play nephews with the Johnson crime family, the drug family that ran a lot of dope out of Detroit at that time in the early 2000s, late 90s. We found out later, years and years later, a nephew of the Johnsons, Santonian Adams, was a Detroit police officer there at the time of the crime, was actually running security for the Johnson crime family as a Detroit police officer.
Anthony's only connection to the Third Street House was through his childhood friend, Marvin Cotton.
I actually didn't know anything about what was going on in the house or the players. Only person that I knew and vaguely knew him was Jamon McIntyre. Marvin and Jamon were good friends. And I had went over there one time with Marvin. We stopped over there. Marvin and Jamon was, you know, having conversations, and they was in their own little circle talking. So he was there for probably about 15, 20 minutes maybe. So that's the only thing that I know about the house. And I don't know how much you guys knew, but prior to McIntyre's death, Marvin had an issue with the police department.
Cotton wasn't the cleanest guy. I think he was selling guns on the side. Well, a Detroit cop lost her gun, and it ended up in Cotton's hands, and he sold it. And the cops busted into his house, strung him up to his shower naked, started berating him, and he filed a citizen's complaint against the two cops, and they ended up getting disciplined.
And I believe one officer was fired behind that. This was like a month or two before McIntyre's murder, according to what Marvin had said, that when he got arrested, the police was talking about him filing that complaint against them.
So he had a target on his back from an unrelated matter, and Legion just got caught up in it.
It probably also didn't help that Marvin arrived at the 3rd Street house shortly after the incident was over, but let's back up to just before. It was shortly after midnight on January 24th, 2001. Jamon McIntyre was on the front porch, and a man named Kenny Lockhart was in the upstairs bedroom with his girlfriend, Renee Tate, while Santonian Adams, the Johnson's police officer nephew, was in a van in the driveway. And he eventually told a story that was partially supported by McIntyre's sister.
Three guys had come up and were hanging around on the porch. Apparently, McIntyre's sister comes over. This is a little bit after midnight. And she's looking for some money. He gives her some money. She leaves. She doesn't recognize any of the three. Shortly after she leaves, Adams is in the driveway and all of a sudden hears shots being fired. Now, at this time, Lockhart is in the bedroom with his girlfriend, hears the shooting, doesn't see any of this, closes his door because he's trying to protect his girlfriend.
Only person who could really say what was going on in the shooting was Santonio Adams. He said he was in a van and he seen two people on a porch shooting. He didn't know which direction they were shooting at. He said he heard Jamon's voice.
And McIntyre calls to him, Tone, nicknamed Tone, as he's running out of the house, being chased by these guys, runs down an alley across the street and gets gunned down.
No witnesses materialized the day it happened. Nobody said who it was.
The sole source of the initial narrative was Officer Adams, who has to cover for why he's at a known drug house to begin with. He didn't make any IDs or descriptions either, but he did claim that he shot at the assailants.
He says, I couldn't find my gun, but as I was ducking when I heard the shots, I saw a gun under the front passenger seat. So I grabbed that and I got off about four shots. Well, he never did turn in his official law enforcement handgun to have it analyzed. When they did take a look at it, they found there were four bullets missing. You have to account for every bullet when you're a police officer. And so they later found there were four bullets missing. His story never added up, but they didn't pursue him.
In the meantime, the police collected evidence. Two guns were found near McIntyre's body in the alley, three more in the house, none of which were claimed by Officer Adams as the one he allegedly used. Now, they dusted the house for fingerprints. Then, for reasons that were revealed much later, Kenny Lockhart went from ear witness to eyewitness, and lead detective Hughes put together a carefully selected photo array for Lockhart to view on February 15th.
I think it was like eight people in the photo array, including me, Marvin Cotton, and Devontae Parks, who was the other individual who was charged in this case as well. Lockhart said that it was Cotton for sure, that he knew Cotton prior to this.
Mind you, Lockhart first told the officers he didn't see what happened, and second, he knew Cotton. So if Cotton had been there, he would have identified Cotton.
And then he said two or seven, meaning me or Devontae Parks, looked like the other individual. That was the identification.
To get around the fact that both Lockhart and his girlfriend, Renee Tate, had made statements that they never left the bedroom and hadn't seen the assailants, the narrative was amended to include the shooters returning to the house after Jamon was already dead to kill Kenny Lockhart.
And he never said none of this on the day of the incident.
Lockhart says that the guys are in his house and a guy he identifies as Cotton tells another guy, shoot him, shoot Lockhart. Lockhart claims he takes a shot, only the problem is there are no bullet holes in the house. Even one of the police officers wrote in his notes, "The guy is not telling the truth. I don't believe a word he says."
And maybe there's something to that, considering that Marvin, Devontae, and Anthony were not arrested until a week later, on February 22nd. And for Anthony, it wasn't even for this incident, but rather for the murder of someone named Devin Taylor.
I get arrested in an unrelated case. This was an individual who I knew. He was killed on the east side. You know, the police, what they did back then was they just rounded up people. Witnesses or not witnesses, anybody without even charges, without warrants or anything, and bring them in and then threaten them, you know, to either coerce them to confess to that crime or coerce them to confess to other crimes. In that process, while I'm in jail, they asking me about McIntyre's case, saying if I say that Marvin and Devontae Parks did it, they won't charge me with that and they won't charge me what I'm already in here for. I'm like, I didn't do either one of these crimes. They said, well, all you got to do is say Marvin and Devontae Parks did it and we'll let you go right now.
But it appears that Anthony's refusal only led to his own charges in both murders.
Now, this whole time while the criminal proceedings is going on, no discovery is coming out. The only evidence that they claimed that they had with respect to the McIntyre case was Lockhart's photo identification saying that Mio Parks looked like the individual. And then when he came to court, you know, he made a positive identification. At the preliminary examination, he said, oh, no, I'm certain. I'm certain it's him. He was the light-skinned guy. And as you see me sitting here, I'm definitely not light-skinned. So that was his description of me. I was the high yellow light-skinned guy. And then by the time it got to trial, he said, you know, he's 90% sure that I look like one of the guys. But moving right before the trial is when they came up with the jailhouse informant, Ellis Frazier.
This snitch witness popped up 5 days before trial, which is when it was disclosed to defense. We have a witness who says that Cotton confessed and implicated Legion. Now, that just shows how weak your case is when you have to come up with something in the bottom of the ninth inning to try to resurrect your case.
My attorney came in with Frazier's statement, and he said, this guy said, you guys down there confessed to him. I'm like, what? My lawyer said, I don't believe none of this shit. This is what Detroit Police Department does, but they're going to use this guy. And so he filed a pretrial motion not to let it in for two reasons. Number one, it was basically a trial by ambush because the police department said that they had this information about Frazier 4 months before the trial. Never turned it over to us till right before trial. So my lawyer argued that it shouldn't come in on that ground. And then the alternative, it shouldn't come in because he's saying that Cotton confessed to him. And therefore, that evidence coming in against me will violate my right to confront Cotton.
Cotton can't testify because he's a defendant and was going to exercise his constitutional right to remain silent.
And I can't cross-examine him.
To avoid violating Anthony's right to confront his accuser, his and Marvin's trials should have been severed. But they continued until the same issue arose again.
Kenny Lockhart, the key witness who the police knew hadn't seen anything, said that he was absolutely 100% certain of the three guys who were charged, Legion, Cotton, and Devontae Park. Only it turns out, right before trial, they verified Park had an airtight alibi.
Park's charges were going to be dismissed, which would have destroyed Kenny Lockhart's credibility, let's face it, and therefore the whole state's case.
If Parks gets on the stand and the agreement that they're going to dismiss charges because he's got an alibi is explained to the jury, well, then there goes Lockhart's whole identification, because Lockhart said he is 100% certain of those three guys, and one of them has an airtight alibi.
The day of trial, we all was in the bullpen, me, Marvin Cotton, and Devontae Parks. But the only two people that they brought out was me and Cotton, and they left him back there. So the jury never seen him, never heard nothing really about him, and never knew that Lockhart made that identification of him.
And the lawyers are going, where's Parks? Because the whole case was all three of them. And all of a sudden, Parks is severed from the case. And Devontae Parks misidentification got ruled inadmissible. It was irrelevant to this case. The whole thing stinks. The gamesmanship of the prosecutor is telling Devontae Parks, we will dismiss your case, but only after the Cotton Legion trial. So they ensure that he does not testify.
You know, most lawyers, they don't call a co-defendant to the stand because their lawyer, co-defendant lawyer, going to say, oh, no, my client ain't getting on that stand.
Because he was still defending at the time and was going to exercise his constitutional right to remain silent.
And so that's why we couldn't call him.
So Devante Parks' case-breaking testimony was effectively hidden from the jury, all while Anthony has another wrongful accusation to fight after this trial, which began in October 2001. So let's start with the physical evidence.
They recovered like five weapons. Two weapons potentially is the murder weapon. All these shell cases, they ran tests on all of this stuff. They do fingerprints inside the house, outside the house. None of this stuff come back to me or Kyle. You got a missing gun by a police officer who admits to firing shots at somebody. And his gun, they don't have his gun. But we do got two guns in the alley. So it's one of them, the guns that he claimed he lost. Who knows? But you got all these witnesses surrounding this house. And nobody said that I committed any crime. Even if you believe Lockhart, which you shouldn't, because he changed his story from the beginning to the end. But he said that I looked like one of the people that was in the house.
The state's evidence simply came to Lockhart and being backed up by a snitch witness, which then would give credibility to Lockhart, right? And as much as the defense tried to punch holes in Lockhart, Lockhart could say, I knew Cotton, so I knew who it was. And then this other guy, Legion, I saw him too. And they never got to hear about the Devante Parks misidentification, which would have been huge. But then Lockhart, and it's backed up by Ellis Frazier, who's saying the same thing.
Frazier testified that he and someone who he thought was Anthony were in one cell, while Marvin Cotton was in the one next door. And Frazier's cellmate allegedly introduced him to Cotton through a brick wall. And then Cotton supposedly confessed, implicating the person sharing the cell with Frazier, who he claimed was named Anthony on the witness stand.
And they said, well, who was Anthony? Oh, Anthony is the person in that photograph, which was Devante Parks. He just got his names mixed up and said Parks was Anthony. He didn't remember the lie enough to you know, come into court and say, oh, no, Devante Parks is the one that introduced.
Years later, Ellis Frazier finally grows a conscience and says in an affidavit that the officer in charge, Hughes, walks him into court and has to explain to him who these guys are, so he makes sure that he picks them out and identifies Cotton as Cotton and doesn't confuse the guys.
So either he got his names mixed up when the police gave him the information, or he just didn't know which person to pick out in the courtroom. But in the jury's mind, where else would Frazier get this information? Not knowing that the DPD ran a jailhouse snitch program on the ninth floor. They provided people discovery material so that they can familiarize themselves with the facts and then come up with a story to support the facts. The jury never knew that. Had they known that, then they would have knew. This is all put together.
Anthony did mount a defense, presenting alibi witnesses to swear to his actual whereabouts, which should have included his co-defendant Marvin Cotton, who had arrived on the scene shortly after the shooting, importantly without Anthony. But Marvin couldn't testify for the same reason that kept Parks off the stand. All the others were loved ones who could be explained away as willing to lie. So that left their last hope, Kenny Lockhart's girlfriend, Renee Tate.
If you look at her statement, she contradicts what Lockhart was saying. She said Lockhart never left the room, never seen anybody. And then somebody got to her and she was shaking and nervous at the trial, you know, and we didn't know why she was, you know, why she was acting like that, but that's what it was. And we found out later she was pressured to stick to the story Lockhart told her.
And this time, it appears that the pressure wasn't even from the police. So both Tate and Frazier supported Lockhart, whose credibility was protected by the prosecutors, who went so far as to say that the Third Street house wasn't even a well-known drug house. Sure, why not? And on October 19th, 2001, both Marvin and Anthony were convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole.
You know, when you hear people say before you about to die, like your life flashes, you know, in front of you, that's what it was like. It was like I seen like everything just flashed in front of me. Like I seen myself as a child, you know, I seen myself, you know, coming through the womb and coming into life and seeing my life snatched. And that's what happened at that split second. But walking out the courtroom, I walked out of that courtroom and said, I'm getting out of prison and I'm about to go in prison and learn everything about this system that did this to me. And I'm gonna get myself out of prison. Before I even got sentenced, you know, I started putting together my strategy on what I was going to do to get out of prison.
And if you remember, he still had to fight the Devin Taylor murder charge, for which he had been preparing his defense until he saw what they were willing to do in the McIntyre case, presenting testimony like Lockhart's and Frazier's while the defense witness appeared to have been coerced.
Once all of this stuff started coming out, I said, oh no, I'm not going to risk getting two life sentences. I had to, you know, resolve that case, because otherwise, guess what? Another jailhouse informant would have been like, oh, Anthony confessed to me. And so I took a plea. I took a no contest plea.
When you've rolled the dice and you come up snake eyes because of some witness that came up 5 days before trial, you don't want to roll the dice again.
And as you can see, they really didn't even care to go to trial, but they just wasn't going to dismiss it. That's why they offered me 8 years.
8 to 20.
So I said, okay, I'll take that deal. Now, okay, I'm going to do this time, but I'm going to start working on this life sentence and get this sentence off of me.
Babe.
Yeah, babe.
Do you think they can hear us?
Yeah, those are mics.
Guys, we are back. We are so excited. It is season two of your favorite New Girl Rewatch podcast. We have got a new season, we got a new name, and we got a brand new episode every week starting July 2nd.
Yeah, I am so excited for you folks to check out this mess around. When I say it's going to get weird, I mean it's going to get
just
weird.
Just okay, save it for the show.
Okay, that's probably for the best.
We've got some of your favorite people from the New Girl universe. We've got the creator and showrunner, Liz Merriweather. We got the Max Greenfield, Olivia Munn.
We also have some of your least favorite. Favorites like Jake Johnson.
Lamorne.
No, I'm just saying, like, if you're listing off your favorites,
Lamorne.
Like, he's still a favorite. He just, Hannah, what's up?
We do have Jake Johnson, though.
Yeah. Listen to The Mess Around on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We all know what that music means. Is somebody getting coronated? No, it's time for the Olympics in Paris.
The opening ceremony for the 2024 Paris Games is coming on July 26.
Who are these athletes? When are the games they're playing? You may be looking for the sports experts to answer those questions, but we're not that.
Well, what are we? We're two guys. I'm Matt Rogers.
And I'm Bowen Yang.
And we're doing an Olympics podcast? Yeah. We're hosting the Two Guys, Five Rings podcast.
You get the two guys, us, to start every podcast. Then the five rings come after.
Watch every moment of the 2024 Paris Olympics beginning July 26th on NBC and Peacock. And for the first time, you can stream the 2024 Paris Games on the iHeartRadio app. And listen to Two Guys, Five Rings on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Andrea Gunning, host of the all-new podcast, There and Gone. It's a real-life story of two people who left a crowded Philadelphia bar, walked to their truck, and vanished.
Nobody hears anything. Nobody sees anything.
Did they run away? Was it an accident? Or were they murdered?
A truck and two people just don't disappear.
The FBI called it murder for hire.
It was definitely murder for hire for Danielle. Not for Richard.
He's your son, and in your eyes, he's innocent. But in my eyes, he's just some guy my sister was with.
In this series, I dig into my own investigation to find answers for the families and get justice for Richard and Danielle. All that they know. Listen to There and Gone South Street on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Criminalia. I'm Maria Tremurki.
And I'm Holly Fry. Together, we invite you into the dark corridors of history and true crime.
For each season, we explore a new theme. From poisoners to stalkers, art thieves to snake oil salesmen, we uncover the secrets of history's most interesting figures, such as Walter Minx, the man who built his own submarine hoping to escape with his blackmail payout under Lake Michigan. It sounds made up, but it's 100% true.
We'll explore the crimes as well as societal forces at play, from unfair sentencing to jaw-dissolving health risks. And tune in at the end of each episode as we indulge in cocktails and mocktails inspired by each story.
Listen to Criminalia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
When I went to prison, the first thing I said after I got processed, where's the library? And so I bought a Black's Law Dictionary. I bought a Michigan Court Rules. I bought a Federal Rules of Civil Procedures. I bought a typewriter. I spent like $1,500 on legal supplies. You know, I wanted to learn that language that they were speaking in the courtroom that I didn't know, and then learn what they knew in order to fight this case.
In December 2002, Anthony filed a motion for a new trial in which he claimed ineffective assistance of counsel for the failure to call Parks as a witness, even though the prevailing wisdom is that a co-defendant's counsel will not advise a defendant to waive their Fifth Amendment rights. This also drew attention to the gamesmanship of the prosecution, effectively hiding the misidentification of Parks and the unreliability of Lockhart. And along with the motion, Anthony submitted an affidavit from Parks, who had plenty that he would have liked to say.
Number one is that Frazier said that it was Parks who introduced him to Cotton, and Parks was involved in the conversation. He just got his names mixed up and said Parks was Anthony. So Devontae Parks would have been able to testify and say, wait a minute, I didn't introduce him, and I ain't hear no conversation about that. So that discredits Frazier. He could have discredited Lockhart by saying, wait a minute, Lockhart said that he knew Parks and that we had all been there on several occasions. Parks could have, no, I don't know you. And he had an alibi for that day, which would have disproved what Lockhart was saying. So that's what the motion for new trial was premised on. And they denied the hearing.
Both of their convictions were affirmed in appeals court in October 2003, and then Anthony filed his federal habeas petition in 2005.
Based on the reasons, the failure to call Parks, the confrontation violation, and I'll talk about that in a minute, and insufficient evidence, because we also argued it was insufficient evidence to convict me of first-degree murder. Even if you look at the case in a light most favorable to the prosecution, it wasn't no evidence that said I committed a murder. Lockhart said he didn't see the shooting. If you believe what he said, he said that the three people came to the house after the shooting. So you have to look at what testimony you had to look at to support that. Frazier's. So the violation of the right to confrontation, the Sixth Amendment, says that you have a right to confront your accusers. Now, in this context, Cotton would be my accuser. If you rely on Frazier, which was the jailhouse informant, the jailhouse informant says Cotton told him, oh, me and Anthony committed this murder and this robbery, even though he doesn't specify who the Anthony is, because remember, he picked out a picture of Parks as being Anthony. But in any respect, I needed to cross-examine Cotton so he could clarify this statement. But Cotton got a Fifth Amendment right not to testify. So that infringed upon my right. Right. So that's why we at trial, we moved for a separate trial, so that Frazier's testimony couldn't come in against me. And the judge denied that. The federal court in 2007 agreed and reversed my conviction and vacated.
And that sounds like it should have been the end of an episode, but we've got over another 10 years of fighting left to go.
In the federal court, when I won in 2007, the attorney general appealed it to the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. And what happened was a new law had came out. So the case that I relied on for the confrontation violation was Ohio versus Roberts. And what that says is you can't allow an unreliable, non-testifying co-defendant statement to come in against another co-defendant. So Frazier's testimony was obviously unreliable. However, they changed that law in Crawford versus Washington, which came out in 2004 after my conviction. And that ruling said the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause only protects testimonial statements. In other words, had Cotton confessed to the police, that statement can't come in against me. But if he tell it to a fellow inmate or a friend or something like that, they said that that can come in against you. And that's why they reversed that ruling. It's an unfair law, but that's what put the life sentence back on me. So what we did, we said, okay, Judge, they changed the confrontation law, which is the Sixth Amendment. Well, now we want to argue the 14th Amendment. You got a due process right to confront his accusers. So it's the same argument, but different constitutional provisions. So the Sixth Circuit said, okay, we'll remand it back to the lower courts and you start that argument all over from scratch.
And while that fight was underway, new evidence began to emerge, starting with Frazier's recantation in 2010.
And so we had investigators, they finally tracked him down. He said, oh yeah, the detectives gave me that information. Marvin didn't confess to me. And then we found out that he also testified in other cases. It's a guy in prison right now, serving a life sentence for Frazier's testimony. A guy named Bobby Smith. And our investigators reached out to him as well. And he said he didn't confess to Frazier either.
Frazier added that he got a 7-month break on a 1-year sentence, but that the prosecutor told him not to say anything about any benefits in court. Frazier gave a second affidavit in 2014, stating in even stronger terms that he never spoke to Cotton and that his statement was completely dreamed up by the prosecution. So with that, the investigators moved on to Kenny Lockhart, who, remember, was staying in the upstairs bedroom of a drug house run by the Johnson crime family.
A guy named Kurt Nard was living with Lockhart, and Lockhart told him the whole story. Told him Johnson offered him $10,000 to pin it on Cotton and Legion, and he didn't want to do it, but $10,000 is a lot of money. And so Nard went to a Detroit police homicide detective, Walter Bates, and told him, even gave Bates the handwritten napkins that he took notes on after Lockhart had told him this. Bates never turned that evidence over.
So it appears the police and the Johnsons were very interested in steering the outcome of the investigation. And then it became clear which of them had gotten to Renee Tate.
Lockhart's girlfriend at the time, who was in the bedroom with him, she's terrified of the Johnson crime family. But she spoke to an investigator for the state appellate defender's office and said exactly what happened and that Lockhart never saw anybody, because neither of them saw anybody. But she is afraid of the Johnsons.
We found out later why. She basically shut down and testified to things contrary to what she put in her statement. She was pressured by Keith Johnson to stick to the story that Lockhart told him.
So what did they do? Like, how low did they stoop?
They was going to kill her kids.
Wow.
Yeah, this was evidence that came out maybe like 2020-ish.
She won't sign an affidavit and has basically said, if you subpoena me to testify, I'm just going to lie and I'll say I never said that. So apparently the Johnsons still have a long reach in the neighborhood.
Babe.
Yeah, babe.
Do you think they can hear us?
Yeah, those are mics.
Guys, we are back. We are so excited. It is season 2 of your favorite New Girl Rewatch podcast. We have got a new season, we got a new name, and we got a brand new episode every week starting July 2nd.
Yeah, I am so excited for you folks to check out this mess around. When I say it's going to get weird, I mean it's going to get
just
weird.
Just okay, save it for the show.
Okay, that's probably for the best.
We've got some of your favorite people from the New Girl universe. We've got the creator and showrunner, Liz Merriweather. We got the Max Greenfield, Olivia Munn.
We also have some of your least favorite favorites, like Jake Johnson.
Lamorne.
No, I'm just saying, like, if you're listing off your favorites,
Lamorne,
like, he'd be... He's still a favorite. He just... Hannah, what's up?
We do have Jake Johnson, though.
Yeah. Listen to The Mess Around on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We all know what that music means. Is somebody getting coronated? No. It's time for the Olympics in Paris.
The opening ceremony for the 2024 Paris Games is coming on July 26th.
Who are these athletes? When are the games they're playing? You may be looking for the sports experts to answer those questions, but we're not that.
Well, what are we? We're two guys. I'm Matt Rogers.
And I'm Bowen Yang.
And we're doing an Olympics podcast? Yeah. We're hosting the Two Guys, Five Rings podcast.
You get the two guys, us, to start every podcast. Then the five rings come after.
Watch every moment of the 2024 Paris Olympics beginning July 26th on NBC and Peacock. And for the first time, you can stream the 2024 Paris Games on the iHeartRadio app. And listen to Two Guys, Five Rings on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Andrea Gunning, host of the all-new podcast, There and Gone. It's a real-life story of two people who left a crowded Philadelphia bar, walked to their truck, and vanished.
Nobody hears anything. Nobody sees anything.
Did they run away? Was it an accident? Or were they murdered?
A truck and two people just don't disappear.
The FBI called it murder for hire.
It was definitely murder for hire for Danielle. Not for Richard.
He's your son. And in your eyes, he's innocent. But in my eyes, he's just some guy my sister was with.
In this series, I dig into my own investigation to find answers for the families and get justice for Richard and Danielle. All that I know. Listen to There and Gone South Street on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Criminalia. I'm Maria Tremarke.
And I'm Holly Fry. Together, we invite you into the dark corridors of history and true crime.
For each season, we explore a new theme. From poisoners to stalkers, art thieves to snake oil salesmen, we uncover the secrets of history's most interesting figures, such as Walter Minx, the man who built his own submarine hoping to escape with his blackmail payout under Lake Michigan. It sounds made up, but it's 100% true.
We'll explore the crimes as well as societal forces at play, from unfair sentencing to jaw-dissolving health risks. And tune in at the end of each episode as we indulge in cocktails and mocktails inspired by each story.
Listen to Criminalia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
They had evidence of, for example, the affidavit of Curtinard, and that helped. But it didn't give them any relief in the court system. The court system is much more focused on procedure than whether you're innocent or whether you got screwed at trial. And finally, in about 2018, the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office opened up a conviction integrity unit. And that was the life-saving process for a lot of guys. And the CIU does its own investigation.
And they spoke with Detective Hughes.
The investigator was a ex-police officer, so he knew the main detective on our case. So he didn't think that this guy would record him, but he got the detective on there admitting that the house was a drug house. And even though they told the jury that it wasn't, he's admitting this. He admitted that Lockhart never gave that initial identification. It was some other guy, a drug dealer, a major drug dealer. And then he admitted to some other things in there that the police officer was basically protecting that house. He was a security for this drug organization. And had the jury known all this, they'd have been like, wait a minute, maybe some drug dealers did this murder. We didn't know that this was a major drug location and that the cop was running security for this operation and that Lockhart never made that identification like he testified to. That would have shredded their entire case.
So this is when Detroit PD officer Santonian Adams was first revealed, and it seems like the jury wouldn't be the only ones coming to the conclusion that this was all related back to the Johnsons.
Everybody in the hood always knows, the streets always know really what happened, that Santonian Adams, who was friends with McIntyre, set McIntyre up. And maybe Lockhart set McIntyre up too, because think about it, if he had been in the house, he'd have been killed too if this was just a robbery for drugs. They would have killed everybody. Word on the curb was that since McIntyre and Cotton were buddies and doing stuff together, Johnson wanted Cotton out of there. So that's kind of how it came down. Johnson was the one orchestrating all of this, whether it was a hit, and then since McIntyre's already dead, Now, if you can get Cotton and Legion, he doesn't want them in the picture. Have the cops go to them.
So it looks like the Johnsons gave Detective Hughes the three names, then gave Lockhart $10,000 to corroborate, and then scared the shit out of Renee Tate while the police and prosecutors went ahead and did the rest.
So the CIU took a fresh look at the case, and then they were able to understand, especially with this tape that the PI had with Donald Hughes, where Hughes admitted that Lockhart hadn't seen anything. Now you start getting into a whole lot of police misconduct that shed a whole new light on the trial and their right to a fair trial. They were robbed of due process. And the CIU concluded that they couldn't say 100% that these guys were innocent. What they did was they said there was so much police misconduct, they were entitled to a new trial. And then the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office realized the flaws with the case and dismissed the charges. But I think what really rocked this case is that the prosecutor's office was very likely involved in this miscarriage of justice with not allowing Parks to take the stand because they didn't dismiss the charges until after this conviction.
Nonetheless, both Marvin and Anthony's charges were dismissed. Anthony told us about how that day unfolded.
You know, in prison, you know, I found inner peace in prison through studying the law. And I worked on other people's cases when I was in prison. You know, I was the go-to guy in prison. Any prison that I went to, I turned the day room into my law office. And I would get me a corner. I have my typewriter set up. I have all my law books. People would come to my office and we working on other cases. You know, I got people out of prison from prison. And so that's what I was doing. And I was actually working on the finishing touches on this brief. And the counselor came in and said, you know, come to the office with me for a minute. Well, you got a phone call. Normally that means somebody in your family done died or, you know, some bad news. So I'm like, okay, here we go. And I didn't even have the CIU on my mind, but it was my attorney and my investigator. And then she said, well, yeah, you know, Kim Worthy agreed to let you go. I broke down in tears. I couldn't even talk. And so the counselor said, we'll have him call you back later. He need to get himself together. So yeah, it was definitely a breath of fresh air when I got that news.
The decision came down on October 1st, 2020, but the nightmare wasn't over. He still had to contend with his 8 to 20 year sentence for Devin Taylor. He was finally released on parole on December 15th, 2020. And since his release, he's been reinvestigating and fighting that case, as well as continuing the practice of law that he began inside.
I'm in the appellate division at Wolf Law Firm, not Wolf Gang, but Rachel Wolf. So I run her appellate division. Then I'm also an appellate consultant in my own office where I do pretty much the same thing, but at a reduced rate for guys who can't afford to pay for an attorney. We do investigation work, briefs, motions, and everything like that. And then I pitch their cases to different attorneys where they can afford them or even do it pro bono. I'm also a member of the Organization of Exonerees. I'm on the board of directors of Safe and Just Michigan. You know, I got my own nonprofit geared towards exposing the falsehood of jailhouse snitch testimony. AnthonyLegion.com. It has my story on there, my Facebook page, Safe and Just Michigan, DJST Task Force. You can also support that, DJSTTaskForce.com. It's nonstop. I work all day, 12 hours every day, trying to save somebody's life from spending the rest of their life in prison.
Meanwhile, Wolf is doing the same on your civil suit.
The problem is civil litigation now. The wheels turn very, very slowly. Right now, we are just in the process after a few years of summary judgment motions where they're trying to throw the case out on qualified immunity. There's a whole nother can of worms, but that's where we're at now. And then they'll kick the can down the road and go to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals if their motion is denied, and it'll drag it out further. And all that does is just kick these guys in the face some more.
It's fucking disgraceful, but we hear the same thing all too often right here. We're going to have both of you linked in the episode description so people can keep up with you, or who knows, maybe they might need your services. So with that, let's go to closing arguments. Thanks again for being here and for all the incredible work you're doing. And closing arguments, Wolf, you start. Anything else you want to share with our incredible audience and with me, of course. And then we're going to let Anthony take us off into the sunset.
What would be a good closing on this story? It's that they, as much as they have been screwed, are trying to give back to get other guys out who they know are innocent in prison, and they're doing the best they can with the resources they have to call attention to wrongful convictions, to the causes of wrongful convictions, witness misidentifications. It's the largest cause of wrongful convictions. Sometimes they're innocent. Sometimes, like this, they're intentional. And they're just trying to do the best they can to make the best of the lives that they've got. And they're doing a very admirable job.
For people that's similarly situated or have loved ones that's similarly situated, don't give up. The road may seem long, gloomy, and dark, but you got to stay focused. You know, you got to stay fighting. And I used to always encourage the younger brothers, don't get caught up in the prison politics. Don't get caught up on a basketball court, on a chess table, playing cards. If you're trying to get out of prison, you have to move like you want to get out of prison, act, talk, walk, sleep, everything like you want to get out of prison, because then the officers are going to respect you in that manner. A lot of the correctional officers knew my agenda was to get out of prison. I didn't care about nothing that was going on in prison. Even though I seen people die in prison, get stabbed in prison, you know, I had to see some horrific things. And again, like I say, I found my inner peace in studying the law. And so, you know, I encourage anybody who have a loved one to go through this and encourage them to stay focused and on type of their fight to get out of prison.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
Guys, we are back. We are so excited. It is season 2 of your favorite New Girl Rewatch podcast. We have got a new season. We got a new name. We have got some of your favorite people from the New Girl universe. We've got the creator and showrunner, Liz Merriweather. We got the Max Greenfield, Olivia Munn.
We also have some of your least favorites, like Jake Johnson.
Lamorne.
Hannah, what's up?
We do have Jake Johnson, though.
Yeah. Listen to The Mess Around on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do, 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 do.
We all know what that music means. It's time for the Olympics in Paris.
I'm Matt Rogers.
And I'm Bowen Yang.
And we're doing an Olympics podcast? Yeah. We're hosting the Two Guys, Five Rings podcast. Watch every moment of the 2024 Paris Olympics beginning July 26th on NBC and Peacock. And for the first time, you can stream the 2024 Paris Games on the iHeartRadio app. And listen to Two Guys, Five Rings on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Andrea Gunning, host of the all-new podcast, There and Gone. It's a real-life story of two people who left a crowded Philadelphia bar, walked to their truck, and vanished.
A truck and two people just don't disappear.
The FBI called it murder for hire. But which victim was the intended target and why? Listen to There and Gone South Street on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, I'm sure you know why we're here. I was like, what in the world is going on?
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.